This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Come to the state of Colorado, as we look over the past centuries or maybe several thousand years, we see really clear evidence of very large and very severe fires having affected those forests and, in fact, having shaped those ecosystems. It's also true that when we look back into the past like that, all of those major fires have been associated with drought conditions. And so the occurrence of a single large wildfire isn't at all unprecedented. But what is unprecedented is the frequency of these large, severe wildfires that we've been having over the past decade or so.
So what, I guess the obvious answer to that is we are having extreme drought conditions, but let's talk a little bit about what is making this drought different from other droughts we've experienced perhaps since the famous droughts of the 1930s.
Sure. Well, when we talk about droughts, we usually talk about a lack of precipitation, but the other factor that's important is also the temperatures, which of course contribute to more rapid evaporation of any precipitation that may have fallen. And so what we've been seeing in Colorado and other parts of the West is not only a decrease in precipitation, but increased temperatures, which have contributed to, for example, earlier snowmelt and a longer fire season and much drier conditions than we would have seen in the past.
So how much of this do you think has to do with climate change, and how much of this has to do with other factors that perhaps natural cycles or perhaps some of the development and changes in land use over the last 1,500 years?
Right. Now, the answer to that question necessarily depends on which area you're talking about, what part of the United States, and what forest types we're talking about. And one of the big obstacles in the national debate on wildfires and fire management has been the temptation for many of us to try to get all wildfires and all ecosystems to fit into a single model, a one-size-fits-all approach, if you will. And that has actually prevented progress quite a bit. So, for example, in Colorado, at lower elevations, we have fairly dry forests that are dominated by ponderosa pine. So these are dry forests. The trees are spread far apart. And in those forests, fire suppression over the past 50 to 100 years has made forests more dense and in some areas has arguably increased the severity and size of wildfires. But as we move up in elevation into some of the forests that are, for example, dominated by lodgepole pine or spruce and fir and so forth, historically these forests have always been dense, and wildfires, when they've occurred, have always been severe. So 50 to 100 years of fire suppression hasn't created conditions that are at all abnormal. So in those forests in particular, climate is really the main driver.
So let's talk a bit about what is happening. I mean, I think most of the listeners understand that the planet is warming. Well, let's talk specifically about how the warming and the other factors that are part of climate change are having impacts on the way what's happening in the forests and how that might make forests more prone to severe fires.
Sure, yeah. Again, the answer to that question depends on what type of ecosystem we're talking about. So let's take the former case that we just discussed, which was these relatively open and dry forests, such as the ones we find at lower elevations in Colorado, such as the ones that we find in, for example, many parts of Arizona and New Mexico. In those types of ecosystems, we say that wildfires are limited by fuels, meaning any given year, it's usually dry enough for a fire to occur, but there's a scarcity of fuels. There's a scarcity of fine material to initiate and carry the fire. In those types of ecosystems, the climatic signal that usually precedes wildfires is a year of above average precipitation, which can lead to the growth of grasses, small branches, etc., followed by a drought year, which dries out all those fuels that have been created. So in those types of ecosystems, it's this oscillation between wet and dry conditions. And the more often that oscillation happens, the more extreme that oscillation is, the more we would expect to see wildfires in those systems. Now, switching to these other types of fires in forests that are usually a little bit cooler, a little bit wetter, a little bit denser. In those types of ecosystems, on any given year, there's no shortage of flammable material. When we go hiking in these forests, we see that they're dense. We see that the crowns of the trees are touching each other. There's simply no scarcity of flammable materials. But instead, what's limiting is dry conditions. And in those types of forests, when you have a severe drought, and especially a prolonged drought, we say the foliar moisture content, that is how dry the needles are, decreases, which allows fires to spread more readily.
Well, we are talking a lot. We had an extreme drought last year. I'm not exactly sure if this year's summer is measuring up to last year's in terms of the extreme drought. I'm wondering how much can we contribute or attribute the current droughts that we've been having over the last few years to climate change, and how much is it that these droughts are cyclical and been going on for hundreds, if not thousands, of years in this kind of cycles that we're seeing now?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that the answer to that is a little bit outside of what I conduct research on. But I can tell you that, again, for a drought to occur is absolutely not unprecedented, absolutely not unusual. But what is unusual when we look back over the past centuries is how extreme and how prolonged the drought conditions are. And if you look at some of the work that's coming from other researchers about looking into likely future scenarios, the predictions are really for continued dry conditions as we haven't really seen in at least the past centuries.
What I found is kind of confusing is I've heard of a lot of different climate models for here in the Pacific Northwest. I know you've done a lot of work in Colorado. I'm not sure how familiar you are with conditions here, but I mostly have heard that the projections for the west side of the Cascades in the Pacific Northwest is to have it be warmer and wetter. But I heard the other day somebody talking about how it was going to be warmer and drier. So I'm wondering, do we have models that really can give us any kind of clear sense of what we're headed to? Or is it still pretty fuzzy about what's, except that I think it's obvious in the Southwest that it's going to get warmer and hotter. But other parts of the country, I'm wondering if there's any kind of clarity about that.
Right. Again, that's a little bit outside of what my own research is on, but what I can say is one of the things that makes these types of predictions difficult is our understanding of the feedbacks that kick in. So, in other words, if you change one variable in a climatic system, in an ecological system, it is absolutely certain to have amplifications and feedbacks that are very difficult to predict. So in some cases, those feedbacks are positive, meaning the response is amplified, so conditions may get warmer and drier. Other times, there may be negative feedbacks that kick in that actually result in cooler and wetter conditions. So I think certainly there is some uncertainty in those models. And again, I would defer to some of my colleagues to get into the details on that.
Well, I'd like to get into some of the areas where you are a little bit more where your research is a little more directed. I know that you have spoken out a bunch about different kinds of forest management related to fire. And one area that you've been talking about is the bark beetle infestations that have been going on throughout the West. So let's talk about that as, for one thing, related to climate change, and then also how that's been affecting conflicting views on how we manage our forests around protecting or what the relationship is between bark beetles and having catastrophic fires.
Right, right. Yeah, this has been a very important theme in public policy debates for the past decade or so. And first, just taking bark beetle outbreaks by themselves, again, when we look at the long-term history of the forests of the Western United States, we see very clear evidence that very large and severe outbreaks of bark beetles have occurred. And so, again, to see a severe outbreak of bark beetles isn't necessarily anything that's unprecedented. But what is unprecedented is the synchrony, the sort of subcontinental scale synchrony and intensity of the outbreaks that we're seeing right now. And as far as the relationship between outbreaks and wildfires, the most natural thing in the world is for us to look at the mountainside of red trees and think that the fire risk is high, and we should be worried about that. And there are two somewhat nuanced footnotes to that. First of all, in many forests that are made up of many forests that are quite dense in structure, meaning many trees, the crowns are touching, etc., under drought conditions, we might look at that forest and see a green mountainside and not realize that the risk of fire is actually quite high, even though the trees are green, but because we're in a period of extreme drought. So when we see the forest all of a sudden turn red, in some cases it's not so much that there's been that the bark beetles have increase the risk of wildfire, as much as it is that they've drawn attention to the fact that there is a risk of wildfire.
So,
now, the second part of it is that when we look at what happens when trees are killed by bark beetle, the tree dies, and the needles turn yellow or red or some color like that, and the needles really quickly dry out. That's the obvious part. That's the part that we see. The other thing that happens, which all of us have observed, if we have ever had a Christmas tree in our house, for example, and that tree dies and starts changing colors to yellow and red, one of the things we may notice that happens simultaneously is that that tree starts losing its needles. The needles start falling off. And this happens very shortly after the death of a tree. So then, in other words, when a tree is killed by bark beetles, you have two simultaneous consequences. Number one, the needles dry out. It decreases in foliar moisture content, in other words. But the other thing that happens is that the crown of the tree actually starts thinning out, a decrease in so-called canopy bulk density, meaning that there's actually less material in the canopy of a tree to carry a fire. Okay, and when our group has looked at the relationship between bark beetle outbreaks and subsequent fires, very consistently, we're seeing almost no influence of bark beetles on fire severity, fire extent, fire frequency. But instead, what we're seeing is a very strong climatic signal driving those fires.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. And for people who are just tuning in right now, this morning I'm talking with Dominic Kolakowski, who's assistant professor of geography at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, and an expert on fire ecology and ecological disturbance, of which forest fires are a great example. So let's talk about what are the climatic indicators that we're seeing, starting back with why are there so many bark beetle outbreaks happening at the same time with such severity, and what does that have to do with changing climate?
Right, yeah. The climatic influence on bark beetles, again, when we talk about that, we have to be careful about talking about which species of bark beetles we're talking about, which species of trees we're talking about. But stepping back a little bit and painting it with somewhat broad strokes, we can say that the climatic influence on outbreaks is such that, number one, the trees themselves get stressed, and their ability to defend themselves against bark beetles decreases. The other thing that happens is that warm conditions, and especially warm winter conditions, lead to an increase in the development of bark beetle populations. So warm winter conditions decrease winter mortality of bark beetles. Warmer early spring conditions and a longer growing season sometimes allow some species of bark beetles to shorten their life cycles and therefore exponentially expand their rate at which the population develops. And all of this leads to a type of perfect storm in which you have more bark beetles attacking the trees, and you have trees that are less able to defend themselves because they're stressed by the warm and dry conditions.
So are we seeing infestations of bark beetles that are unprecedented, or had there been other times when there have been infestations like this and forests have been able to come back?
Yeah. So our group has done research on two types of bark beetles. Spruce beetle, which attacks the different spruce species, and mountain pine beetle, which has been in the news quite a bit more, and it attacks the various pine species that are across Western North America. And as far as spruce beetle goes, in Colorado, we have seen very strong evidence that there have been major outbreaks of spruce beetle in the 1940s, which have actually been historically documented and of which there are photographs and written records and so forth, and also in previous centuries, in the 1840s and also in about the mid-1700s, and then going back farther in time, the record gets a little bit fuzzier, but we see evidence of pretty severe outbreaks about once a century, at least in various parts of Colorado. For various methodological reasons, it has been harder for our group, as well as other research groups, to reconstruct and to be able to describe and understand the long-term history of mountain pine beetle outbreaks. So one of the things we hear quite often is that the current outbreak of mountain pine beetle is unprecedented over the past century. We have never seen anything like this over the past 100 years. That's absolutely correct. There's no doubt about that. But if we say something like that, we need to hold it in a larger context and remember that many of these forests are shaped and have been shaped by events that are quite infrequent, and meaning wildfires or insect outbreaks that occur on the order of 100 years or several hundred years. So to say that something is unprecedented over the past century actually isn't telling us that much about a lot of these systems.
So I'm wondering if this is something we should be worried about, because there is, I would say, a fair amount of hysteria about the bark beetle infestations. And in fact, last summer I was driving down to California from Oregon and was going past the Shasta Lake area, and there were all these red trees, and I had just recently read Andy Nikiforuk's book about bark beetles, and I was just horrified when I saw the actual, you know, trees that were dying. And then the next time I was going on that route a few months later, I looked at it and went, well, it doesn't really look that bad. You know, we have this knee-jerk reaction to us. I'm wondering, is this something that we should be hysterical about? And is this something that we should be starting to do all kinds of managed logging programs to in order to stop the beetles?
Right, yeah. It's an interesting question. You know, there was this large outbreak of spruce beetle in the 1940s in Colorado, which I mentioned. Everybody was very worried about that. People were worried about what will become of the forest. People were worried about wildfire risk. People were worried about all the things we could possibly be worried about. They were worried for about 50 years. And actually nothing really catastrophic manifested as a result of that outbreak. And if you walk through these forests right now, to some people they look like old-growth forests. There are many dead standing trees. There are many dead fallen trees. And certainly there are many live trees of all different sizes and different species. So historically, forests have had an ability to regenerate and recover following bark beetle disturbances. Now, one of the things that we don't know about the current outbreaks is how the climatic conditions after the outbreaks are going to affect the forest's ability to regenerate. Because after every major outbreak over the past centuries, conditions have been much cooler and much wetter than they are now. So it's an open question as to how these forests are going to be developed. We can say with absolute certainty that in the past, forests have regenerated after very severe outbreaks. And we also have to acknowledge that current climatic conditions are quite different. And it's an open question as to how that is going to play out. Your second question has to do with what do we do about all this? Should we manage the forest? If so, how should we manage them? And in my opinion, whenever we ask a question like that, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that we want to accomplish? Because if we're talking about public lands by design and by definition are lands of multiple use. And it follows from that that there's no one answer to the question, should we manage forests after bark beetle outbreaks? It depends on what we want. One of the conversations that has been going on for a number of years in Washington, D.C., as well as at the state level in various states, is how do we reduce the risk of wildfires, given all the changes in forests that we've been seeing? And so if we take that as the goal, let's say our goal is to protect homes and communities from wildfires. And the question is, what can we do to attain that goal? So if we agree that that's the goal, or at least one potential goal, then a couple of things come into play. Number one is, again, as we discussed earlier in the program, that the effect of bark beetles on subsequent fire risk actually pales in comparison to the overriding effect of climate on wildfires in many different forest ecosystems. So if we're worried about protecting our homes and communities, it's really the climate that we should be thinking about more so than the bark beetle outbreaks.
So what do we do?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what do we do about that? I mean, it's we seem to be having a hard time globally coming to a consensus about how we're going to deal with the climate. So as a disturbance ecologist, how do you see that we should be facing this question, particularly since it seems to have a big effect on any kind of disturbance that our natural systems experience?
Right, right. Yeah, and these are very difficult questions. And I think with a question like this, we can take the short-term approach and we can take the long-term approach. The short-term approach involves recognizing that that as a country, we're increasingly building homes and communities in inherently flammable ecosystems. Ecosystems that have been shaped by wildfires for centuries. And doing this is much like building our homes in floodplains or on the side of volcanoes. Right? The question isn't whether a flood or an eruption is going to happen. The question is, when is it going to happen? And given that we know that it is going to happen, what do we do about it? And some of the work that we've done, along with several other research groups, really clearly shows that what determines whether or not a given house burns down is not the condition of a forest. In a remote wilderness area. It's not the question of whether or not there has been a beetle outbreak somewhere far away. But instead, what determines whether a given house is going to burn down is what is surrounding that house. What is in the immediate vicinity of that house? And the immediate vicinity, we're talking, you know, 100, 150 feet around the house. And what is that house made of, right? Do we have wooden decks touching pine branches, or have we employed some sort of non-flammable building materials? And it's actually treating the area in the immediate vicinity of homes and communities that's most important to protecting those homes and communities from wildfire. And incidentally, we last year, a couple of years ago now, we did some back-of-the-envelope calculations and found that if we cleared the flammable material away from every single structure in the 13 western states, we would actually end up treating an area that's much smaller. It's a small fraction of the area that's currently being affected by bark beetles. And this type of treatment would effectively protect homes from wildfires, whereas chasing these bark beetle outbreaks isn't really going to do very much because, again, as we talked about earlier in the program, given drought conditions, the risk of fire is going to be high regardless of bark beetle outbreaks. So the short-term perspective, if we want to, for the time being, protect our homes and communities from wildfire, it absolutely makes sense to focus all of our management efforts in the immediate vicinity of our homes and communities. Now, the second question you brought up is the more difficult one, right? The longer-term perspective, which is what do we do about the changing climate? And that is something that we need to have a very open and honest conversation about at the state level, the national level, and the international level. And that is something that individual forests, individual states probably won't be able to address. It really has to be a coordinated effort.
Well, we're talking this morning with Dominic Kolakowski, who is Assistant Professor of Geography at Clark University and a specialist in disturbance ecology and fire management of our public lands. And we're talking about how climate change is affecting and exacerbating wildfires throughout. Well, we've been mainly talking about the Western United States, but it's true, Dominic, actually they've been exacerbating them around the world. as we've been seeing in Australia and Indonesia and in Russia in recent years. So I want to actually go back a bit and talk about this term that's used that maybe a lot of listeners don't understand. What do we mean by disturbance ecology? What is it that you're studying exactly?
Sure, yeah. So when we talk about things like wildfires and insect outbreaks, we customarily talk about them from the perspective of our human society, the perspective of what does this mean for our homes, our communities, our ability to use public lands, etc. The term disturbance ecology takes these same disturbances, like wildfires or insect outbreaks, and studies them, examines them from the perspective of the ecosystem. In other words, we look at what is the role of things like wildfires and insect outbreaks in the development of forest ecosystems. And we, as a scientific community, have come to understand that, in fact, most ecosystems, not only most forest ecosystems, not only in the Western United States but elsewhere, have been shaped and have been influenced by natural disturbances like fires or insect outbreaks, maybe hurricanes, earthquakes, other types of things. And so, from the ecological perspective, that is to say, from the perspective of how a forest develops, a disturbance is not a bad thing, it's not a good thing, but instead it's just an integral function of an ecosystem. It's how an ecosystem works, if you will.
Well, I had the experience of really seeing it close up hand. There was a big fire on the north side of Mount Hood 2 years ago, and it burnt a lot of my very favorite areas where I go hiking and camping. And so last year I got to go through that area for the first time as a burn, as opposed to being this really lush forest. One of the things that really struck me is this ridge, the trail that you go up to this part of Mount Hood is called the Vista Ridge Trail. And I've been going up there since the early 70s, where you'd have great vistas looking north and east of Mount Hood. And in the last 15, 20 years, the vistas kind of disappeared because the Douglas fir had gotten so thick. And one of my first thoughts when I heard it was on fire, which was, of course, damn, I won't be able to go hiking over there this summer. And it was kind of a personal thing. Then I realized this is going to be a really, you know, major change for the mountain, probably mostly for the good. And maybe we'll be able to get those vistas back. And when I went up last summer for the first time after the fire, there were those vistas again. So it gave me a very drastic sense of it, that nature does rather dramatic things to get itself back in balance, it seems. And so I wonder if we talk a little bit about how the fire regimes in forests actually keep the forest in balance.
Right, yeah. Again, it depends on what type of forest ecosystem we're talking about. And then the other thing that we have to keep in mind is we can talk about how fires have affected forests over the past centuries, and then we can come back and talk about whether or not that is likely to continue or whether things are likely to change. But let's take a simple example. So these low elevation dry forests that we talked about earlier, such as the ones that we may find in places like Arizona and New Mexico. Historically, the role of fires in those systems has been such that fires have been very relatively frequent, let's say occurring every 5 to 30 years maybe, and also relatively low severity, meaning relatively few trees were killed, and the ones that were killed were it tended to be seedlings and saplings and other small stems. And the result of all that was that the fires maintained these kind of open structures, the things that we may think of as parks commonly. So that has been the role of fires in some of those ecosystems, again, primarily very dry, low elevation, kind of southern forests. In other systems, maybe ones in more northern parts of the United States at higher elevations, kind of weather conditions, denser forests. There, historically, the role of fires has been such that every few hundred years, when climatic conditions are right, you would see, or you would have, quite a large, quite a severe wildfire that may have actually killed most trees over very, very large areas. And then what followed was an establishment of a new forest that began growing and colonizing the area in which trees had been killed by this large, severe fire. And in terms of some of the consequences of that, which is one of the things you alluded to, some of the consequences of that are, for example, we know from our previous studies that younger forests, forests that have established more recently after severe fires, are actually less susceptible to outbreaks of bark beetles, and they're also less susceptible to damage from strong winds. So there's this type of feedback with other types of disturbances.
So let's talk about what happens now if we have stand replacing fires like we've been having and what happened on Mount Hood 2 years ago. How is that, the ability for the forest to regenerate itself, going to be affected by climatic changes?
Right. That is exactly the question that our own group, and I know several other groups, are working on right now. Because, again, as we said early in the program, looking at it from a historical perspective, that is, looking back over the past couple hundred years, what we see is really clear evidence of large fires followed by very rapid establishment of new trees that, that have grown into the forest that we see now. But again, the post-fire climate over the past centuries has been much cooler and much wetter than it is now in many cases. And so one of the things that some researchers, including our own group, are seeing, at least on a somewhat informal level, is that there's a scarcity of regeneration following some of these large fire events. Now, why that is still an open question, but some of the likely hypotheses are, number one, that we have this wildfire. Even if it was exactly the same type of wildfire that would have occurred over the past centuries, afterwards, the conditions are simply too hot and too dry for new seedlings to establish. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that because the current wildfires are occurring under such extreme climatic conditions, they might actually be burning hotter than previous fires. This is something that's difficult or maybe even impossible to quantify, but it's one hypothesis that's out there. If that's true, then these recent fires might actually be affecting the soils more so than previous fires, making it more difficult to establish. Most likely, it's a combination of all these factors. Now, again, with where our research stands at the moment, we can't say, and I'm not saying at all, that forests are not going to regenerate after these fires that we've been seeing over the past decades. But what I can say is that regeneration appears slower and sparser than it has been in the past. And how that's going to play out is still an open question. Is it that it's just delayed and sometime in the next few years or maybe decade or two we'll see much more regeneration? That's possible. Is it possible that some of these forest ecosystems are going to be converted to non-forest ecosystems let's say, replaced by grasses or something like that. That's also possible. And we just don't know, and it's a real edge of current research, again, for our group as well as other research groups.
Well, it sounds like there's a good chance that we are going to need to learn how to adapt rather rapidly to changing conditions. And you mentioned a little while back about the importance of fireproofing homes in the woods. But I'm wondering how we change the mindsets of people who decide to live in the woods and who decide whether to live in floodplains of wild rivers that are going to eventually change course and go right through their house, or people who live in the woods and do not want to have a metal roof or a fireproof material building their house because they want to live rustically. How do we get it across to people that you can't live this way anymore?
Right. That's a very, very difficult question. You know, and I think it's difficult for all of us. I mean, I personally love being in the woods. I personally love being in a log cabin in the middle of a forest, deep in the wilderness area. I love that as much as anybody. And so how to have those conversations is, I think, a very delicate topic. One of the things that I know is playing out in practice is that insurance companies are considering ways of taking up that very conversation, because in the end, either the insurance companies or the federal government end up picking up the tab for a lot of this destruction. And so insurance companies are looking at ways of giving people breaks on their fire insurance for reducing the flammability of their house, either by doing things like having tin roofs or maybe clearing out the area around their house and so forth. And I believe that in upcoming years and decades, we're going to see that conversation pick up and gain momentum. Because in the end, somebody is picking up the tab for this, and it's either the insurance companies or the federal government, meaning taxpayers.
Well, it's a conversation that I hope to continue on this show because I think it's a really important one to be having. And I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Dominic Kulikowski, who's assistant professor of geography at Clark University. Thanks a lot. And you've let us know a lot more about what is really going on with fire in the woods.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, Locus Focus goes on a break until September 9th, and then I'll be joined by Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute to talk about coal and oil trains and pipelines being proposed for the Pacific Northwest. Have a great rest of the summer. It's a great summer, so get out and enjoy it. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Michael McDade. We're going to go out with some music by the Neville Brothers. Thanks for listening.
Fire on the mountain. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10:59.
KBOO Community Radio and Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 are proud to co-sponsor a special presentation on Thursday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. An insider's account of Guantanamo will examine the illegality, immorality, and inhumanity of the U.S. Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, with Stephen T. Wax, Chief Federal Public Defender for the District of Oregon, Laura Sandown, a U.S. Navy veteran who served at Guantanamo, and S. Brian Wilson, a longtime peace activist, among others. An insider's account of Guantanamo will take place at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com.
Welcome to Radio Zine. I'm Ren Green, and today I'm speaking with Portland animator Kathy Hart about her short film, Torn.
How do you describe your film? I'd say that Torn is an experimental animation that uses rotoscoping techniques to capture some indexicality of human erratic dance to describe my response to... Sorry.
It's okay.
It makes me cry. Your film is about eugenics.
Yes, it is.
In Native American populations.